This is a Mentoring Developers podcast, episode number 45.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Hi, everyone. Today, I have Sara Inez Calderon. Sara, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing real good. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, and you've been on the show a couple of times already. People can check it out. And just search for Sara Inez Calderon on mentoringdevelopers.com or Google it. You'll find it. But today, we're not going to talk about you and your first job and how you got your second job and all the wonderful things we talked about earlier. We just want to talk about some stuff that's going on in the world. We're going to talk about some interesting articles that I discovered. We're going to discuss that. Also, I want to talk about some interesting things that I am doing. And then you have some questions. We're going to answer that.
Cool.
Okay. So the first article that I want to discuss is the 2016 top programming languages list that was published by IEEE.
Sure.
Did you read that? What do you think?
I did read it. I think it's interesting. These lists are always kind of curious to me because I think they're certainly flawed depending on who is putting them together. Secondly, I think that all of these lists are pertinent to different people in different ways. Obviously, if you're talking about, you know, startups, or if you're talking about finance or the medical industry or media, you're going to be skewing these ratings differently. If you're talking about educational technology versus corporate technology versus government technology, there's going to be a variety of different contexts in there. But yeah, that's kind of what I thought. I mean, certainly it looks like these traditional tried and true object-oriented languages are here to stay. You know, you have C# and Java and PHP. Then you do have kind of what I would probably think of more startup-y languages on there, or newer, you know, JavaScript and Ruby and Go. So yeah, and then one thing we were discussing is that R is moving up, which is super interesting given probably the R and Python, given the, you know, surgeons of data science, which I think is pretty cool. We're actually looking for a data scientist at my job right now, and I never really given it much thought, but it's a lot of skill to be a data scientist. And so those are my thoughts. What do you think?
I think this IEEE listing is very interesting because they're not trying to find an objective way of ranking programming languages. I think there is no objective way, but some people do that. Some people, they try to, for instance, look at references for that particular programming language on github.com. So they assume, so if it's on GitHub, then they can just do a search on how many, for instance, projects are in Ruby, and then they can have a number that they can quantify their popularity. But of course, that's not really accurate because not every project is on GitHub. But IEEE is not even trying to do that. What they say is that there is certain presets that you can use. They have a formula. In that formula, they use certain presets. Let me read that. They say the default preset is intended to echo the interests of the average IEEE member. So in the eyes of an average IEEE member, the highest language or the most popular language is C, right? What do IEEE members do? They're electronic engineers or computer engineers or computer scientists, but a lot of the computer science people, they are in IEEE. They're also in ACM and some other organizations. And
that's a good point.
Their interests are different. A lot of times they're doing hardware related work, or they're Or they might also be doing some research. So let's look at their list. They list C as number one, Java number two, and then the list goes on: Python, C++, R, C#, PHP, JavaScript, Ruby, Go. That's an interesting mix if you think about it.
Yeah.
R in a programming language. R, you know, what is that for? That's for statistical analysis, but you know, not many people have heard of it. But according to the IEEE membership, it's number five on the list.
Yeah, exactly.
So that list is a little bit skewed, but it does give you the idea. If you want to build firmware-based or a hardware-based or a low-level application, then you're going to use C. If you want to build an enterprise application that is more traditional, you're probably going to look at Java. If you end up in a situation where your organization is tied to the Microsoft platform, then you're probably going to look at C#.
Yeah.
Right? If you are building an embedded application. And for instance, your microwave, your smart fridge, and a lot of your smart devices, they have software running inside of them that lives inside a very, very tiny computer that has very small amount of memory. It's a small, really weak computer, and all these other things. So you don't have a full runtime environment for Ruby or even JavaScript or Java virtual machine. It's hard to do that. So you get down to the low level where you can work with these small amounts of memory and processing power. So you either use C or C++.
Actually, can I ask you a question? Because that's a really good point. What were like the TI-83s programmed in? Do you know?
Yeah.
I never thought about it before. I never thought about it before until you said that those little bitty computers. Anyway.
Yeah. So that's interesting because the TI-83 or any kind of programmable calculator or smart calculator, if you want to say that, they are coded in a low-level language itself. The program that is the calculator itself. The calculator is a piece of software, right?
Sure.
That runs on very specialized hardware. And I don't know what specific calculators are written in, but I'm sure that they're either written in C or C++ because that gives them the power and the memory address capability. You can pinpoint a piece of memory and say, I want to do this here because you want to be efficient. So
wow. Well, I just looked it up and it appears that you're right. It's written in its own language called TI Basic.
Well, that's different. Well, so this is what I wanted to, sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to, well, let me separate it out. There are two things. One is the actual program that's running that comes from the manufacturer. That's actual the calculator program.
Sure.
Right? That's one. But then these are programmable calculators, so you can actually write programs as a student.
Yes.
As a user, you can do that, but you're not going to write programs in C and C++ on that. They're not going to even let you do that because then that means that you can then change the actual calculator itself. They're going to give you a higher level programming language, which is easy for users to do. And that's generally BASIC, the basic programming language, very simple syntax. To be honest, I have done that when I started programming when I was in high school. That's where I started.
That's hilarious. Yeah. What did you do?
I built a very, very interesting interactive game.
Oh my God. You must have been such a nerd. I would have loved it. Oh my God. You could have helped me with calculus. It would have been awesome.
No. Let me tell you, I was never good in math. I was okay in calculus. Overall, I was terrible at math. So this is I had the calculator not because I was a math nerd, is because I really struggled. So I really wanted an advanced calculator. Once you have that, if you start reading the manual, you'll start saying, oh, okay, there are these instructions and there's this simple programming language, which is very similar to the basic programming language, which is where I started my programming.
It's
simple stuff. And you have these little characters that you can use. So for instance, I use the less than and equal to character as a sailboat.
That
kind of looks like a sailboat. So you know that you can draw and erase things?
Yeah, sure.
Just by drawing and erasing things, you can have a sailboat move. And this game was about having sailboats move from different directions. And then when they collide, if they collided, then I would turn that less than or equal to sign into a not equal to. And if you know what a not equal to sign looks like, it is a equal sign with the cross, with a line across
it. Oh, it's like an explosion, an exclamation point. Yeah.
It actually, to me, it looks like, so if you alternate between an equal sign and not equal sign, and if you just flip them back and forth, it kind of starts looking like somebody's rowing a boat.
That's so cool.
That's kind of what I did. And if you kind of move it along a horizontal line.
Yeah.
And just flip between
them. Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
It looks like somebody's wrong about it. It's kind of silly things that I did in high school.
That's cool. Anyways, I didn't mean to get you off topic, but that's a really good story. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah. Well, it just brings back memories. And
that's cool.
You remember those things. Like, I have done a lot of coding, but I can never forget that because that was my first experience. And I didn't have a computer. I didn't have a computer. All I had was a calculator.
TI-83. That's so cool.
All right.
That's cool.
Okay. So the next article is something that I think you'll enjoy talking about. Is an article on InfoWorld 7 bad programming ideas that work.
Yeah, seriously. So many.
And they have a picture of a donut.
Burger.
The donut burger, yeah. It's a glazed donut with a hamburger patty. So it's a burger, just they use the glazed donut as a patty.
I thought this was an interesting article. I think it makes a lot of assumptions about time and budget. But like quick and dirty code, wasteful algorithms, using a separate database server, using a big CMS to hammer on a tiny nail, integrating display with data, using a suboptimal foundation, keeping dusty code in production. So those are the 7 ideas in here. So I'm just going to go through one by one. Quick and dirty code, that's always kind of the epic wars between engineering and, management, right? Management has deadlines and management has things that need to happen for business purposes. So sometimes quick and dirty code is the only way to go. Or if you're at a hackathon or if you're coding something in your spare time. So wasteful algorithms. I think this is more of like a programmer type deal. I've seen these guys just like spend hours, trying to do something clever, which it's like, what are you doing? They're just trying to impress themselves on each other. Using a separate database server, I can't really speak to that because I don't really do server-side stuff. Using a big CMS hammer on a tiny nail. What I would say with this is I think that a lot of people in tech overestimate how technically savvy people are outside of their domain. So I don't know that this is a bad choice, actually. I think if you're going to have people who don't know anything about technology using a CMS, you need to, even if the CMS is big and clunky, like just use it because the purpose of the CMS is for other people who don't know tech to use it. Integrating display with data. This is super duper important, but yet so hard. I think a lot of people try to do this who aren't design minded, and it's sad. So using a suboptimal foundation. This is another thing that assumes budget and time. What are you going to do? Sometimes you start something and by the time you get halfway through it, you're like, oh man, we shoulda, coulda, woulda. Keeping dusty code in production. I mean, this is another thing. Like, what are you going to do if you don't have budget to hire someone to refactor code? So those are kind of my thoughts. I feel like a lot of these articles are like idealistic is the word I would use. What do you think?
So let's go through them just a little bit slower so we can really understand what this idea is and what we think about it. So quick and dirty code is the idea that you have a deadline. Perhaps your manager comes to you and says, we need this in 2 hours.
Yeah, exactly.
That happens a lot, right? So the first question is that a reasonable thing to ask if you're a manager? Is that something reasonable?
Never is, yeah.
It depends. And a lot of times it probably speaks to the fact that things are happening a little bit more ad hoc. Maybe a little bit more planning would make things easier. But, things can happen. Now, if that happens, maybe it's not 2 hours, maybe it's 2 days, then you have the opportunity as a developer to say, I'm just going to just get it done and have it do the right thing most of the time, at least in your initial testing. You try it out a couple times, okay, it works. How it works exactly, you're not entirely sure that it will work in all cases, but it works, and when there's a problem, you deal with it. So that's an approach. I think that I have seen people use this approach. Personally, I think it's better to take the time to understand the problem and to devise a solution that will stand the test of time. It doesn't have to be completely a solution that you're planning several years in advance, or you want every edge case to be covered. So you are trying to build a gigantic solution with many, many layers of abstraction that you may not need because maybe this is not a long-lived project. So you have to do your due diligence. You have to see, balance the pros and cons. But a lot of times it comes down to understanding what the problem is and creating a solution that will actually work in production. So think about all the different things that can go wrong. If you can write automated unit tests or integration tests for that, that's going to give you some confidence. And I think it's our responsibility as developers to is to produce code and produce software that, you know, is reliable. I mean, if you hired a plumber to fix your leaking faucet and kind of fixed that, but then it did something and broke your pipe.
Yeah, that's true.
I don't think you will have a good impression of that person. So if you constantly, if that's all you do, is just do quick and dirty and quick and dirty.
That's true.
Then something will give, and then it's not going to look good for you.
That's a good point. That's an excellent point. You must have seen this happen before.
It happens all the time. A lot of times I find myself in a position where I'm leading a team and there's an existing code base, and the attitude is that this thing just needs to get out. We don't even care if it completely works. We just need to say that it's done.
Yeah.
Because we have people breathing down our neck.
Yeah.
That's an unfortunate situation. I know why people do that, because they're afraid for their job and this and that. But any piece of software that is critical for an organization, I would think that that company or that manager would really want it to work
all the time,
and not just appear to work, right?
Yeah.
So the next topic is wasteful algorithms, and don't be too smart for your own good.
Oh, that happens all the time.
Maybe you don't need to create a clever algorithm if something off the shelf will work, right? If there is a way to sort a list that comes with the library that you're using, and maybe you don't need to create your own. And so that's part of it. And a lot of times off-the-shelf libraries are preferable, because you will end up not having to test it and maintain that code.
I've even seen people, they'll use like Lodash or something when they could have just done like, you know, like to sort an array or something, you know? You're just like, okay, guys. Like, it's like there's this whole like obsession with like, you know, tools and like libraries and like, this is so cool. I want to implement it because it's cool. You know, that kind of just like, okay, guys, whatever.
Yeah, I think that it happens a lot in the front end world, because
probably
people like to have,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you want to have experience and keywords on your resume. That happens a lot. But so this is kind of the flip side of the argument. My original argument that I said was that use a library when you can. In this case, a library may be overkill because you're not using it for most of the project. You're using one function. And sometimes these libraries can be broken down, and you can just maybe a customized version of the library. You can just say, I want this function, and that you can do a custom download. That happens. So that's better. But it's an interesting choice. The problem with, for instance, you used the example of Lodash. If you're using Lodash for just one little thing, but then that Lodash library is getting included in all of your pages, so that will increase the size of your pages.
Yeah.
Which will mean that the experience for your users could be pretty bad. On the other hand, if you know that your users are on a very good internet connection, they're not on a mobile device, for instance, and maybe it's, you know, the customers and they're all in their offices with fast internets, then I think that then it's a good choice.
Yeah, that's true.
That's not a concern. But if you're making a website that you expect people to access from different devices in different countries, then yeah, you should really, really pay attention to your payload or the size of your page.
Yeah.
These libraries, they can be pretty big.
Yeah.
Also, I should mention, while we're on this topic, that if you find yourself in this situation where you really want to use a library, but it's kind of overkill, maybe think about using a CDN, a content delivery network, that will alleviate it, so they don't download it from your server, they download it from another server, which is, first of all, going to be fast, but also it is possible that it's already cached in their system, so then they don't download anything. So there's some pros and cons here. Okay. Then they talk about using a separate database server. I think we can just skip that. The next interesting topic is the CMS. Now, not everybody's going to know what a CMS is. So what is it?
A content management system, such as WordPress.
Yes. So many people may not know what WordPress is. So let's define
really?
What...
Oh, my God.
Well, not everybody knows this.
No, that's true. That's true. I hadn't even thought about that.
Right. Remember, a lot of my audience, a lot of people listening to this podcast, have never done any programming.
Yeah.
So, and they may not have ever built a website.
Well, they've probably gone to a WordPress site without even knowing it, though.
Absolutely. But let's talk about what a CMS is. A content management system is kind of a turnkey sort of solution for building your website. A website can be done from scratch. You can type it by hand. You can use a framework to help you out. But there are some websites that help you make other websites. So WordPress is a website, but that actually helps you make your own website off of that. And it gives you all of the ability to save content and sort it and search it and display it in a certain way. It gives you a lot of capability right off the, as soon as you install it, and then you can change it based on your requirements. And if you are a content-heavy website, so for instance, if you are writing a blog or you want to have articles, or if you're writing a book and you want a website that showcases a book, a content management system will be great. Now, this topic is, what's this topic about? Using a big CMS hammer on a tiny nail. So use CMS for everything. They're saying don't use CMS for everything.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Yeah, well, that happens a lot. So if you have a CMS that is a content management system that is overly complicated, maybe you don't need it.
That's true.
But as you know, and as I know, that most websites on the internet run on WordPress, which means it's actually, for most of websites that you might think about building, if you were trying to build a photography website, or even if you're building an e-commerce website, you want to sell some things, you'll be able to use a content management system and use some add-ons, plugins, themes, and so on to customize it.
Well,
and I would say, yeah, well, to your point earlier, you said that if you can use a content management system and get done faster, that's better for you than try to come up, you know, with a custom solution.
Well, and then first of all, I think a lot of developers, they like building things, right? So they want to start doing stuff from scratch. But what I think is great about WordPress in particular, because I've used several, so just real quick background, I used to be a professional journalist, and we used kind of different types of content management systems within the newspapers where I worked. But WordPress is, and then I've, you know, written for different publications. So, but I found that WordPress is across the board one of the more intuitive, easier to use CMSs. And, you know, I think what a lot of engineers forget sometimes is that you're building something, but you're not going to use it. So nobody cares what you think. Developers, I know a lot of the developers I know hate WordPress because it's ugly and it's clunky and you have to use PHP, which nobody seems to like for whatever reason. It's not new, I guess. But, you know, it's easy for end users. So, you know, maybe WordPress isn't the best solution for you, but you're not the one who's going to be using this. So, you know, that's kind of what I think about that.
I think the best reason to use a WordPress or another CMS solution is that people have learned lessons over time, and they have developed solutions and add-ons and a lot of themes and widgets that you don't have to do anymore, because maybe you're trying to do something that somebody else has done.
Yeah.
And that's great. And also, the idea that you don't have to start from scratch every time means that you can churn out websites pretty fast. If you have two similar-looking websites, you can use the same WordPress theme and then just tweak it a little bit, and you have two websites, right? And that's something that a CMS solution makes very easy. However, having said that, sometimes it is an overkill.
Yeah.
In situations where you have a very targeted audience, let's say you're building an internal website for a company that is going to do a couple of little things, and they don't have a blog, and they're not writing articles, and they don't need to have comments.
Yeah.
Right? Comments are another great feature of WordPress.
Sure.
You don't need to have that. You don't need any of the bells and whistles. You're not going to customize it. You're not going to use Twitter, Facebook, add-ons. You don't need any of that. Well, maybe you can just do a custom solution that is going to be very fast, and that could be the right thing for you.
Yeah.
So let's see. This this last thing that I want to talk about, I don't want to talk about every little point that they have, but the suboptimal foundation. Now, that's just some mumbo jumbo, right? What does that mean? Suboptimal.
I mean, foundation. Yeah, I think that's basically like you can totally. Well, what my mentor, my teacher, told us when we were designing our first app, Gregorio Rojas from Sabio, you've had him on your show. He said, look, there's a fine balance between like not planning anything out and over planning everything. So we have to kind of find a happy middle ground here. You know, you're never going to be able to fully spec out everything that you're going to need from the beginning of a project. And so that's kind of what I think is weird is that, you know, suboptimal foundation, the sense of like, you didn't pick the best solution for the problem at hand. And it's like, well, you don't always know what all the problems are when you start out. So those are my thoughts on that.
Yeah. So there is a term that we like to use in web development, especially. It's called YAGNI, YAGNI.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that stands for?
No, I have no idea.
You ain't going to need it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it means.
Yeah.
You're not going to need it. If you are trying to plan this big architectural solution, you have this whole idea of having these advanced libraries and frameworks and this and that, and you're just starting out, you're just getting a feel for what kind of product you're building, maybe you're not going to need it when it comes down to it. So don't preempt these types of optimizations.
Yeah.
However, having said that, it's very important to have a good idea of where you want to end up, maybe in the short term, maybe in a few weeks, few months time frame. You can say, well, you know, I would like for them, for instance, if you know that you're going to have a blog on the website with comments, right?
Yeah.
And you say, oh, let me build a Ruby on Rails website, a custom Ruby on Rails website. Okay, well, that's great. But then you're going to have to build a blog in Ruby on Rails unless you can incorporate some of the CMS. There's some CMSs that just plug into
a
Rails solution, for instance. That's fine. But then you need to think about it. And maybe you're really comfortable with WordPress and you know you're going to have a blog. You don't need all the bells and whistles that WordPress has. But if you know you're going to need a feature that is really well done in WordPress, well, maybe you should pick that. So there is some of that. You need to do some planning.
Sure. Yeah, you have to. Absolutely. You can't just start. That's insane. Yeah.
And you should always be ready to pivot, which is, this isn't exactly what we needed. Let's go back to the drawing board and switch things out. I think that's a good approach. You need to always be nimble, but always be rooted at the same time.
Yeah.
Hey, I noticed that you signed up for my email list that I've been going on mentoringdevelopers.com/list.
Yes.
So, and you've been going through that email course that I started. This was about how to, okay, it was 5 steps to be successful as a software developer.
Yes.
Okay. That was my first time writing these types of email courses. So I wanted to know what you thought about the emails and the writing style and what did you come away with?
Sure. So there's a lot of emails. So for example, I guess I could compare this to like Egghead, right? That website. Or like even like the Angular newsletters that I've gotten. And I feel like with those, they're always trying to, well, not so much the Angular one, but certainly the Egghead one. They're just trying to sell you stuff. They're trying to get you to buy things. What I really enjoyed about your newsletter was one, like you did mention the writing style. I liked the writing style. I felt like you were talking to me and it was, you know, fun and it was informal, but personal. So I really enjoyed reading that. And because of the topic, you know, I felt like it was useful to me. I mean, there's been a little bit of chaos at work. We've been trying to hire people and we've been rebuilding our API, re-architecting our API. So the senior front-end developer left and I'm the junior front-end developer. So it's just been really crazy. So it was really nice to read, you know, like it almost felt like you were, you know, talking to me. Or just having a conversation about like, hey, like the bigger picture, you know, this is just a step on your journey. That's kind of how I felt. That was my experience of reading these newsletters. And yeah, so I felt like it was actually useful to me in terms of like my professional development, given all that I mentioned previously. And also, I just enjoyed reading it without a read. I enjoyed reading an email where no one was trying to get me to buy something. And, you know, because so much of our email these days is just that, right? So, yeah, so that's kind of how I feel about it.
That's really good to hear. The reason I started that email list is because I want to have a conversation with the audience. There are a lot of people that listen to this show. People have come to me and they said, this has changed their life. This has really inspired them. That's great to hear. But what I want to do is offer something a little bit more, because I have a lot of ideas and thoughts that I've developed over the years. I talk to a lot of people, as you know, on the show as well. And I have a lot of things that I can offer to people, but I just don't know what exactly they want. So it would be great if people that are listening to this show, they want to have a conversation with me. Maybe they're looking for a mentor. Maybe they have certain struggles that they're going through, or certain things that they would like to learn about. And just sign on to the email list at mentoringdevelopers.com/list. And then when they sign on, they'll get these emails. But then they can reply to me, and then I can answer their questions. And also, I can also, you know, do a custom course for somebody who has a problem that they're dealing with that I'm not aware of. And maybe I'll be able to do a custom email course for that.
Sure. Oh, well, I just thought of two things. So one, I didn't know that I could just respond to the newsletter and you'd get that email, because a lot of times you can't do that. So you might want to put that at the top. Say, hey, you can always hit reply if you want to contact me. The second thing is that I had mentioned this to you, is I think it'd be cool if you link to different podcasts in the context of your blog. Because, for example, I literally was reading something and I was like, man, I wonder if he has a podcast about this or so I think that'd be cool. Cause I know, you know, for me, like I really enjoyed, listening to Gregorio's podcast with you, for example, and, this, I mean, I think you interviewed a lady who kind of trained herself up as well. So, I mean, I really enjoy some of the podcasts. I think they're very inspiring, but practical at the same time. So that might be something you could do
right,
too.
So I could have a section on the website that lists podcast episodes based on topics. And that's a good idea. I should probably do that. And I can also send emails. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I mean, like when I'm reading the newsletter and it says, you know, sometimes you have struggles, but you have to believe in yourself if you want to overcome these struggles. And that entire sentence is a URL that leads to a podcast where you talk about your journey to being a developer or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, or you have a sentence in there that says, some people attend boot camps and have a lot of success doing so. And that entire sentence is a URL that links to Gregorio's podcast. You see what I'm saying?
I see that. Yeah, I think that's a good point. There are lots of links out to other things that I can include. I think that one of the things that people sometimes get scared of is getting links because they don't know what it leads to. Sometimes other advertiser websites.
That's true.
If you sign up for my email list, you get an email from me. And if there is a link that is an ad of some kind, or if there's some way that I am using that to make money, which I'm not right now, but if in the future, if it happens, I'll make sure that I mention it. So.
Sure.
Yeah. That people who are listening to this podcast, they can trust me completely, because I'm not making money from this. This is something that I enjoy doing, because this is a service that I want to provide. But as you know, that
I know, I can testify to that.
but at the same time, why are other people not doing that? Sometimes that's their business, but in other times they will just recoup their costs. You know, it's a lot of expense to run a podcast. I would love to be able to offer a service that they can benefit from. And maybe it's a book that I can write, or maybe it's a course. If they like these courses that I'm doing in email, maybe they'd like to sign up for a more involved, more one-on-one course, maybe with audio, video, and other materials that'll be targeted for them. And that maybe that might be worth paying for. That's not something I'm doing right now. But if I ever did something like this, you will know. I will never trick you into doing it.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So I would like everybody to who is listening right now, just go online, go to mentoringdevelopers.com/list, sign up, get the emails. You're going to get 5 emails about how to be successful as a software developer. And then hit reply and tell me what you want me to write about. If you have any comments, suggestions, improvements, anything like this, I'd love to hear. But the other thing I want to talk about is when I was trying to see, okay, what topics would interest my audience? So what I did was, since you and I had talked about using ECMAScript 6, which is a new version of JavaScript, and some of the comparisons between the new version of JavaScript and the older version of JavaScript and how they compare, some features, how they have transitioned, and how you can take advantage of the new features. If you're a newbie especially, there's some really cool features in ES6 or the new JavaScript that you can take advantage of, and you can avoid a lot of the problems people have. So I just did a course on that. I've had it in my computer for a while. I wasn't sure if people are really interested. So that's another thing. If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're interested in learning more about the new version of JavaScript and how it compares to the old version.
Yeah, that was a great presentation too. I really enjoyed it. I would watch it again.
And we can do... So that's a presentation that I did, and you were in that presentation. I could give that presentation also, but it can also be an email course so that you can read it. Sometimes people don't have the ability to watch a video presentation. Sometimes they just have the ability to read, maybe at their work or something, so they can then sign up. So that's the idea. But I want people to get back to me and let me know if that's what they want, because I don't want to give you material that you're not interested in. If you are interested in ECMAScript 6, JavaScript, and to really learn some practical, really, really practical tips on how to improve your JavaScript game, then yeah, let me know. What else, Sarah? We were going to talk about...
We didn't go over the imposter syndrome blog.
Yeah. No, well, before we do that, I think that... So earlier we were talking about some ideas on...
Sure.
What other things people might want to hear or people might want to learn from this email list. Do you have any ideas on that?
So what I think is kind of cool, as I was mentioning to you, I did Angular. And then I transitioned to my second job to React. And quite recently, I was tasked with, so we had this gentleman who was a functional programmer write some React for us. And I was charged with implementing that into one of our current apps. And I was so blown away because I had seen in one of the components, there's a ref where the component is referencing itself. And I was like, oh my God, what is this doing? What does this mean? What? You know, it really blew my mind. And I had to just go back and read the React documentation and read some blogs so that I could understand what was happening there. And once I understood what was happening, I was able to make a course of action for myself, right? Okay, this is how I'm gonna have to do this. It kind of jogged my memory. I mean, as I was researching this, one of the articles I stumbled upon was, JavaScript as functional programming, React as functional programming. And so I work with a Haskell developer and I have a good friend who is a Clojure developer. And in the course of, hanging out with them, we've had these conversations about the future of, software development in general. And as processors do not kind of get faster and faster and faster as they did for the last 20, 30 years, how are you going to gain speed in all of these different applications and devices on which we're using this software? And so I think it's an interesting idea. I'm not super educated on the topic, but the idea that functional programming is what's going to allow us as humans, technologists, to create that speed, to move away from object-oriented programming and move into functional programming in order to create the speed that we need that we can no longer access from processors. So I don't obviously know a whole lot of this aside from a few conversations and reading a few blogs, but I think it's a super interesting topic. I think you should have a roundtable about it on a podcast. I think that'd be really popular. But yeah, that's what I was saying.
That's an interesting topic. Functional programming is not necessarily at odds with object-oriented programming. You can have a functional programming language that
sure.
is also object-oriented.
Yeah.
But I think this happens because there is now a new tension in the industry, in the open source world, where people want to move away from object orientation and they say, well, it's not needed. Well, that's an approach that's possible.
That's, sure.
But I think the key point that you were mentioning was that processors have stopped being faster because we have reached a physical limit on what we can do with the silicon.
Yeah.
So that's fine. But you know what happens? Now, instead of on one single chip that you have, your processor chip, you actually have multiple processors, your multiple cores, which essentially means multiple processors.
Sure.
In essence. So if you have a quad core computer with four cores, what that means is that you have four independent processors. Perhaps they're sharing some resources on the actual chip
itself. Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that they're sharing some things. I'm not sure. I have not been keeping up with it, but I'm assuming that they're sharing registers and some other wiring and all this. But what they can do now is, even if they're running at, let's say, 2 gigahertz, and they're in the past, you could say, well, in a few years, you will have a 4 gigahertz processor. Okay, well, maybe instead of getting a 4 gigahertz processor, which means everything runs faster, which means your program just get faster just because you're running on a faster computer. Now what you have is you have four different computers running at 2 gigahertz, but four independent computers, which means now instead of being able to do one thing at a time, you can do four things at a time.
Mm.
So it's parallel processing. Well, think about it. 4 times 2 gigahertz in theory is what, 8 gigahertz? So even if you could double your processor, a parallel computer, a multi-core computer could still be way faster.
Yeah.
But it's not. And the reason is that the way we write programs are kind of, they are sequential.
Single-threaded, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not easy to separate your program out into separate individual units of execution, right? One thing depends on the other thing.
Yeah. I get that. Oh, okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
If you have one thing that depends on the next thing, then they can only happen in sequence.
Yeah.
And it really doesn't matter how many cores you have. And that's our challenge.
That's true. Oh my gosh, you're blowing my mind right now.
But if you are somebody that is interested in functional programming, you learn functional programming, you know that it operates on individual pieces of code that are executed in their own context, which are functions. Functions, lambdas, and so on, right? There are these little pockets of code that run. So that means if you have code that uses these lambdas or these functions, then if you have four of them, can you execute them in parallel? It's possible and it's conceivable that you could do that. If you write your program in a certain way, you might be doing, let's say that you want to aggregate information from four different sources, and you can isolate the code that fetches the information from these sources into a function. I'm just creating a scenario in my head. These are independently executing functions that they do whatever they need to do, and they're sort of independent. So then you can dispatch them in all these different cores, and then you can collect the results back when they're all done. So you're going to be faster. So the way to go faster these days is now to do things in parallel. So that's what it is. We can talk about this, but I'm not sure. Honestly, I'm not entirely sure if the people in this audience are thinking about that. If obviously I want to hear.
That's true.
I want to hear from people like, okay, so if you're listening to this podcast and this topic that I just described fascinates you, let me know so we can talk about it.
Well, the way that I first heard about functional programming is, you know, instead of passing around objects, you pass around functions. And that idea blew my mind. So I think that if you talk about functional programming in the sense of like, there's this whole other paradigm of software engineering that you've never heard about before. That's where I'm coming at it from. I'm not talking about like trying to be all fancy and stuff, but you know, it's like, wow, like you're actually, you know, when you do callbacks and stuff, like that's like the idea of functional programming or whatever, you know, like that's what I think is cool about it.
Right. I think that implicitly a lot of functions, when you pass functions around, functions either are themselves objects or they're encapsulated inside an object. So
sure.
If you are passing a function, you're probably actually passing an anonymous object that contains this function. So it just appears that you're doing that. So you're still passing objects, and there's a, it gives you the ability to be modular. And I think
sure.
that's key. So,
but I mean, just mm-hmm. just to explain like kind of what you're doing to someone who doesn't know functional programming.
Yeah, I think that could be a great topic. You're right. I think the other topic that I would be really interested in talking about and exploring is non-coding. I understand that programming itself is very interesting and it's critical. If you want to be a software developer, that could be a critical skill. But I think there are other skills that are not actually programming, but they're, or they might involve programming, but there's not just, all of it is not just programming. It's maybe thinking about things certain way. For instance, how do you design
sure.
or architect a solution given a set of parameters in a certain situation? There are different ways to go. How do you make that choice? That's a difficult thing to talk about. If you have real-time concerns, if you want something that is real-time, like chatting, what should you use? That's a whole another set of topics that I would love to know if people are interested in. The other thing that could be interesting would be how to write a good unit test. How to write?
Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, it's not easy. It's not obvious, but there is an answer. There is, or let's say there are multiple answers. All of them could be right. But if you know your choices, then you'll probably be able to
exactly.
make the choices. There's that. I'm also interested in talking about how to structure your code, for instance. This is,
yeah.
This could be.
I think that's, yeah, because it's just like writing. Like, you know, I think that there's some really explicit information about how to structure your writing, right? You have a thesis, and then you have arguments that support your thesis, and then you have a conclusion that summarizes all of your supporting arguments to support your thesis, right? I mean, everybody learns that in school, but how do you structure software? I mean, I'm sure it's similar, but it's different.
Okay, so we're going to keep talking about this. I think I would love to have this conversation with you later on after you've gone through some cycles in your work, and then maybe you can give me more feedback. My audience,
sure.
people are listening to this podcast. I'd love, love, love to get their feedback. They can do that by signing up to the mailing list and then replying to me. But we still have one more article we need to talk about, and that's actually a pretty interesting topic, a little bit uncomfortable. How to overcome imposter syndrome. Do you know anybody who suffers from that?
I know a lot of people who suffer from that. So I work with women who code here in Austin. I'm one of the co-directors. And what ends up happening is that we have a lot of folks, we have a Slack channel, and that's always a topic of conversation. It's always like, I feel stupid, or how do I overcome this? Or does anyone have any advice or any good articles? And, you know, I mean, I feel it too. I felt it. I was telling you, I felt it this week. And I was kind of hunting around online. You sent me this article, on Medium, Developers, How to Overcome Imposter Syndrome. And I mean, I don't think that there's just one way, right, to deal with this. I think that because, so this is my personal opinion. I think that this whole idea of imposter syndrome is really the product of, in my mind, working in a very male-dominated industry, because a lot of the men that I've worked with kind of have this attitude of, oh, you don't know that? You don't know that? Like, how do you not know this? And I'm like, oh my God, dude, why are you being a jerk? You know what I mean?
They actually say that?
People have said that to me, not just one time. And if it's not explicitly, you don't know that, or, oh, I didn't know, I thought you knew this, or something like that, something to that effect, that happens. So maybe that's something you don't know, but yeah, that happens. So I think that definitely can contribute to you feeling like you're stupid, right? I mean, that's the intention. It's this very like male hierarchical thing that happens in software. And second, because the women that I work with are always like, oh, well, what it means is da 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 da, let's Google it. See, here's an example. You know, that's kind of been my experience with women who code, is it's not necessarily combative, it's more collaborative. So I think that that's where a lot of this imposter syndrome stuff comes from. At least the imposter syndrome stuff I read, it's all about, you know, women. This is the first imposter syndrome article I've read by a man, Abhishek Pillai. So that's my first point. My second point is that because there's this kind of, I would phrase it as hostility towards ignorance, ingrained in the software industry, you kind of have to find a way to deal with that on your own terms. And so, you know, sometimes you just feel bad at work, and sometimes you're just having a bad week, right? So I feel like sometimes labeling imposter syndrome, it turns into this thing that people do, but I don't always know if that's helpful. And I know that's probably an unpopular opinion. Like, I don't know that if it's helpful for me to keep on harping about how I have imposter syndrome. You know, like maybe I just had a bad week at work. Maybe I was fighting with my friend and that made me feel bad. And then I feel bad at work or something. That's kind of how I think about it. But all that being said, this week I did feel a little bit like I started Googling imposter syndrome. I was like, well, what's going on? This particular article has some helpful hints, you know, get a mentor, get a peer, pair as in pair programming, surround yourself with smart people, be curious, pick something in practice. Make decisions consciously, be aware that you're experiencing imposter syndrome. Those are all really great suggestions. I guess the one problem that I've experienced is I have tried finding mentors. You've been a really great mentor to me. You've been very helpful. Some of my friends, I've been building different apps with some of my friends, but they can't always answer the big questions because we all went through boot camps. None of us are really computer science people. And then being curious, I think that's probably the best thing in practice. So I bought this React course on Udemy and I've been going through it and it's excruciatingly slow. But it's been really helpful for me to go through every single step of things because hidden between all these things that I already know is, oh, that's what that does. So for me, practice makes perfect. I mean, that's an adage for a reason. And also, being curious. So we do a lot of custom CSS styling at my job. And so I've had to become familiar with browser compatibility and, rotating SVGs and CSS and Flexbox and all of these things that I never really had to do before. And so I dove right in and I took a couple of, YouTube courses about Flexbox and learning about all these CSS properties and really trying to dig in to, Flexbox in particular. But also I still am a little bit, I still have to look it up, things like visibility and display and things like that. These nuances only really matter sometimes. And so I don't really commit them to memory unless I need them. So that's what I would say about the imposter syndrome is I think that it's a mix between having a bad day at work, not having support, being in an environment where you're put down or people try to make you feel bad about not knowing things. I don't know that it's a syndrome per se, but for me at least, it's kind of a fleeting feeling that I'm sure I will get accustomed to and or understand as part of my job in a reasonable amount of time.
I think most people go in and out of this feeling of feeling like an imposter. It's not a constant. It's about confidence. It's about how confident you feel in your own abilities. And sometimes people are being nice to you and they listen to your opinions in meetings. They listen attentively, which makes you feel like, okay, you have something worthwhile to offer. But if some people are talking past you and they just shrug you off, that's going to dent your confidence. When that happens, you're going to have an imposter syndrome. It can happen to men. Something that I haven't told many people, I'll tell you right now, is something very similar to what you described has happened to me when I started out.
Yeah.
It happened to me and people would be really jerky about these questions. Oh, you don't know this? And they would assume that, okay, they are basically judging me and trying to find if I'm worthy of working there, right? You're constantly being judged. You constantly have to prove yourself worthy of being hired alongside these luminaries, right?
Yeah. Luminary, wink, wink.
Yeah, I mean, these are people like, oh, I can't believe you don't know this. And how did they hire you? You know, I had to learn all this and you didn't. So, you're taking advantage. So if you're a woman, they're probably thinking, oh, she got hired because she's a woman. Or if you're a minority, they're probably thinking, oh, affirmative action or whatever they're thinking.
Yeah.
They have these biases. Exactly. They come to it. Listen, people, if you're thinking that you know everything and people who get hired have to be as knowledgeable in everything as you are, you need to stop right now. because people are different and they have different strengths and weaknesses. And you're not perfect either. And we can all help each other. When you help somebody, when you teach somebody that you know that they didn't know, first of all, you're going to be a good person. Right? You're going to sleep well.
You're going to be a happier person too.
But also you will be, first of all, helping somebody, but you'll be helping yourself. You will be somebody that is going to know this topic better because then you explain it first. Second, it gives you the opportunity. Okay, well, this person needs this information that I have, but this person doesn't have. There will be a whole lot of other people that will also need this. Let me make that into a video that people can listen to. Maybe this could be a conference talk. That's an opening, an opportunity for you, silly.
Sure.
To be...
That's a great attitude.
To be out there and actually prove that you are knowledgeable. Well, that's just a very selfish reason. But other than that, helping people is a good thing. Is a good thing. If you have the opportunity and the ability to help somebody, do it and don't be a jerk.
Well, and I would even take what you just said further. And if you're in an organization, let's say you're in like a corporate environment or even if in a startup, stopping being a jerk and teaching that person something is going to make your job better and your product better and your team better, you know? And so this attitude of, you know, dismissiveness is actually antithetical to capitalism and success. And I would even say that the thing that bothers me the most about that attitude is that when these men have mentors or when these men have friends that teach them things, they don't consider themselves stupid. You know, I worked in places, I was literally interviewed by a guy who gave me a coding test. And before he administered it to me, said, man, I couldn't have passed this when I applied here. So how come he's worthy of working there, but he was trainable? But if I don't know it now, I'm not worthy of working there. You know, I've worked with guys who had literally senior developers sit next to them for the first 6 months of their job and teach them things and have them there to explain things to them, then tell me, you don't know that? But when they were getting mentorship and when they were getting help, that was just normal. And of course, they get that. But if I need that, then I need to step up. So that's kind of how I feel about that.
Yeah. I completely empathize with your situation. So this programmer culture, I think that it's time for this to stop. In this idea that you need to have people you want to hang out with. So if somebody is exactly like you and wants to hang out with you, that's the only way they're going to be good members of your team. This idea just needs to stop. This is a silly idea. There are people from different backgrounds, different ethnic, religious backgrounds, and you know, male and female and so on. There's a mix of people, older people, younger people. They all have something to give and contribute in a way that's different from you. They're not going to be like you.
Absolutely.
They're not going to be your clones, and they shouldn't be because we need the diversity in our industry and at your company, at your place of work. It's going to be actually better for you too. So I think that's the message that we want to give out. But also everybody, even the person who is acting like he knows everything, even that person probably suffers from imposter syndrome. And perhaps they want to cover for that, or they want to project their insecurities out onto other people. That's another thing that I empathize with them also. I understand that you need to assert yourself to feel like you're worthy of your position. And that's something that happens. This is what happens when we have a bunch of 20-year-olds in important positions in a company, 20, 25-year-olds.
That's true.
They haven't figured out how to deal with people. They haven't figured out what they're good at. They're still learning about life. So this is the problem that we have with our industry. People are just very young. As they get older, in their mid-30s, hopefully they would have learned their lessons. But if you are somebody who is younger and you've been hired as a developer, be kind to other people.
Yes.
And also encourage other people. There's no way that encouraging and teaching other people and helping them succeed will diminish from your power and your prestige. It'll only increase.
I agree. Absolutely agree.
All right. I think that this is enough enough lecturing from me for one episode. We'll continue. We'll talk about some of the other articles and some other interesting thoughts that you have later on, perhaps when you have time, come back on the show.
Heck yeah. It's always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure having you, Sara. And I wanted to say that I want to make you an honorary host of Mentoring Developers, because after a while you'd be it's Arsalan and Sara at Mentoring Developers. We'll see if we get
there. Man, that's cool. I'm actually thinking about getting into the podcast business, so I'll let you know.
Yeah, absolutely. If you need any advice on how to get started, I'm here to help you.
Thank you. You're so great, and I really appreciate all the work you do. And I'm looking forward to the fourth installment of my How to Be a Better Developer course. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. So go ahead and sign up if you haven't already. MentoringDevelopers.com/list. This is a 5-email course on the 5 skills you need to have to be a successful software developer. All right, Sara, you have to say bye now.
All right, sir. Ciao.
Ciao.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed the show. You can read the highlights and show notes with links on MentoringDevelopers.com/episode and the number of the episode. For example, MentoringDevelopers.com/episode 10 or /episode 25 and so on. Let me know what you think about this episode. If you'd like to ask a question or if you have a comment, you can email me at us@MentoringDevelopers.com. Oh, and one more thing. I really want you to be part of the show, even if you are a little shy. So go ahead and type MentoringDevelopers.com/join in your web browser. This will open a Google form where you can tell me what topics interest you and what dates and times you're available for about an hour or so. Everyone is welcome, and I would be thrilled to get a chance to talk to you. I'm really looking forward to hearing from you at MentoringDevelopers.com/join.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at MentoringDevelopers.com.